Okay, we're starting with the Arachayim Parshas Bo. Wanted to first start off with a beautiful hashkafa that the Arachayim presents. It's on page Samach Gimel in these versions, Perek Yud Aleph Pasuk He. At when the idea of Makas Bechoros is first introduced in the parasha, the pasuk says, "Vayomer Moshe, Komar Hashem." Moshe says, "This is what God said." I'm going to I'm going to go out into the midst of Egypt in the middle of the night. And every firstborn in Egypt will die. From the firstborn of Paro that sits on his throne, even all the way down to the firstborn of the maidservant, and even the firstborn of the animals are going to die. So in terms of understanding Makas Bechoros, the Arachayim gives us a tremendous tremendous yesod, the basic concept in Hashkafa. V'lo omar v'horagti kol Bechor v'yoski Hashem Baruch Hu poel hatov v'yodo aval pe'ulas hora yitzav l'mesharsav osei dvar v'hem lo yasu v'ze lo omar v'horagti Ela umeis pirish al yedei shaliach. Umeis Hashem heima haskas hodas habuchara zehu. Vizagarn ki amashas yashli senu umeis. Vizay yiskala pirish alavi kesi shehu al yedei shaliach. The first thing the Arachayim addresses the issue. You know, it's interesting that the way the pasuk describes the death of the firstborn is in a passive voice. Umeis kol bechor be'eretz Mitzrayim. All of the firstborn will die. So, Arachayim, you know, you would think offhand that the more normal way to express it would be in a more active sense. Ve'horagti kol bechor be'eretz Mitzrayim, says the Ribono Shel Olam, I will kill all the firstborn in Mitzrayim. I mean, after all, that's what's happening, right? I mean, usually we remember from our composition classes from way back when, if you have a choice of expressing a certain thing in an active voice versus expressing it in a passive voice, it's always more straightforward and, you know, reads better to express it in an active fashion. So why does the pasuk say, umeis kol bechor? Almost like, you know, they will die of their own accord, you know. No, v'horagti kol bechor, I will kill the firstborn. So the first thing the Arachayim says, which really goes back to something we spoke about last week's Parashat Vayera, is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes care of good things himself. When it comes to doing bad things, HaKadosh Baruch Hu delegates. He's a good CEO. Right? He likes to take care of the good things himself. Hashem Baruch Hu poel hatov biyodo. HaKadosh Baruch Hu does good things personally. But pu'ulas hara yitzav l'mesharsav osei divaro v'heim yasu. Some kind of evil thing, which again is God's plan, and God, you know, commands that it happen, but the actual execution is delegated to God's servants. Right? Right. So we'll talk about that a little bit later in this Arachayim. I just want to bring this particular point really goes back to the point which the Arachayim made in last week's parsha, where again according to the Arachayim's reading, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is critical of Moshe Rabbeinu for saying Lama Harayosa La'amazeh. Right? And Moshe Rabbeinu says to Hashem at the end of Parsha Shmos, why did you do evil to this nation? And the Arachayim says that at the very beginning of Parshas Vayera, HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes Moshe Rabbeinu to task for saying that. And what the way the Arachayim explains God's, you know, complaint back to Moshe Rabbeinu is that no, you can't say about God that God does evil. God may, you know, command the evil to happen. God may direct for the evil to be carried out. But to say Lama Hari Osa, the fact that you did evil is just the wrong thing for a Jew to say. Whenever we talk about evil befalling somebody, it's always a result of the evil which that person does, right? That the person's sins catch up to him. And when we talk about doing good, it's only then that we invoke the name of God, Tov Hashem Lakol, V'rachamov Al Kol Ma'asov. Right? So this Arachayim follows up that similar position of the Arachayim. Good comes from God, evil comes from God ultimately, but in the immediate sense, you know, again, the Ribbono Shel Olam is the one who delegates when it comes to the performance of evil. So Umeis Kol Bechor, the pasuk doesn't want to say that Hashem, V'horakti Kol Bechor Be'eretz Mitzrayim, right?
Maybe the reason it says that the evil of Malach is because in the point of view of Klal Yisrael, that the Amish is doing pure good, so he takes complete credit for it.
Okay, could be. Let's see, the next thing that Achaim says is another attempt to address this issue. Why it doesn't say v'horakti? Why it just says umeis? Right? And here the Ar Chaim launches into a much longer explanation, which again is just a tremendous yisod. Oh, yirtza al derech omrim zal yoyvoy enei v'katlik v'gam omru nasa gal shalat somos. Ar Chaim writes, another way perhaps to explain the use of the passive voice over here as opposed to the active is based on an expression Chazal have several different places where Chazal describe how, let's say, a certain person says or does something unseemly, and one of the rabbis looks at him, Yahiv Be'ene, he looks at him, he put his eye on him, V'katle, and he killed this evil person. Or Yahiv Be'ene V'nasa Gaushal Atzamos, right? He looked at him, and the guy became a pile of bones. And the one reads this Gemara, or these Gemaras for the first time, it is struck. So how do you get this laser vision? You zap somebody by looking at them. Rei dvarim elu bashkofer rishona yirachakim hasechel. Says the Ar Chaim, you read these Gemaras at first blush, and it seems to be fantastic. It seems to be something unbelievable in the literal sense of the term. Something that you can't believe. It seems to defy logic. How can it be that a tzaddik would look at somebody and be able to kill him? His question is not so much the scientific question. How can it be that, looks can kill, right? How could that be? Okay, looks can kill. There are all kinds of miracles we have. But notice, it's bothersome theologically, says the Ar Chaim, that a tzaddik, by looking at someone, should inflict injury upon him. Tzaddikim do good. Halo ksiv. The pasuk says in Mishlei, that tov ayin hu yivorach, right, which the way the Ar Chaim is interpreting it over here means that, the one who has a good eye is going to be a source of blessing for someone else. A tzaddik should bestow blessing and goodness and happiness. Tzaddikim shouldn't be killers, that tzaddik, that tzaddik looked at me the wrong way, and boy, was I shaking in my boots, it seems odd that tzaddikim can kill, with their vision. Right? And if you look in the Zohar, he says, the Zohar talks about a person who's ra'ayin. We talk about ayin hara, but bad people give people an ayin hara. An ayin hara is the sort of thing you associate with someone who's stingy, who's not a good person. Right? So how do you have tzaddikim giving, so to speak, an ayin hara? I'm sorry? Not about Rav Shimon bar Yochai. In other words, what he's talking is, he's quoting a Zohar, and the Zohar is authored by Rav Shimon bar Yochai. So he's quoting Rav Shimon bar Yochai as the passage of the Zohar. Right. So the truth is, he doesn't mention that over here, but Rav Shimon bar Yochai and his son are the two who come out of the cave and seem to be zapping people with their eyesight as well, right? So that, although he doesn't mention it, it's a similar type of question, to what he's raising over here. Achein. Achara Ashkofa Bediktuk Omrim Yohiv Eine Hoyalomar Ro'o Bo Be'enav. You want to try to explain this, says the Ar Chaim, let's pay close attention to the Lashon. The Lashon doesn't say that he looked at him in all of these cases. It says Yohiv Be'enav, he placed his eye upon him. That's literally the translation. What does that mean? Eloyoski Kochelik Rasha Baholo Behechrech Ki Yelo Dover Hamaimid Koshuhume Achiyuni. Right, so he says the following idea. Again, a lot of this is, I guess at least semi-capitalistic, so we're not going to totally understand everything, but he says as follows. Tov, goodness, is associated with chayim, with life. Ra, evil,
is associated with Malchus, with death.
Ra, pure Ra, can't survive in this world, because pure Ra is death. So if you have a person who's a Rasha, who apparently has a lot of Ra, of evil in him, there must be something cementing that Ra in place. In other words, giving that Ra the ability to live within a human body. So every Ra, every you know, even a Rasha who has a lot of Ra in him, must have at least a little bit of Tov inside of him, which is, so to speak, you know, keeping the person alive. Because if a person was pure evil, who's 100% Ra, he would never be able to live. Like, the very definition of Ra is synonymous with death, with Misa. So if you have, you know, it's a contradiction in terms to say that you have 100% Rasha who's walking and breathing. Right? So if a person is walking and breathing, even if he has a lot of Ra in him, there must be some Chelek Tov. There must be something good in that person, which is simply keeping the person alive. Well, the Zet Haskil Lahavin Ma'amar Amzal, that explains the Gemara in Sukkah. The Gemara in Sukkah describes how God is going to shech the Yetzer Hara, which he identifies as Samuel, the Satan, that the Ribbono Shel Olam is going to shech the Yetzer Hara at the end of days in full view of the Tzaddikim. Udvarim elu ein lahem hashmos, ki lo yutzak shechita l'malach. What does that mean? What does it mean to shech the Yetzer Hara? Or, you know, when he talks, when he identifies the Yetzer Hara with the Satan, who after all is a malach, how can you shech the malach? How does that work? How do you kill an angel? Ulamashik dam utiyah kavon ki osir mimero chelak hamichayeyu v'asaras mimero chelak hatov zeu shchitasa. What this means is that all of the goodness will be removed from this malach, from this Yetzer Hara. I mean, after all, the Satan himself is not such a bad guy, Chazal tell us. The Satan is just doing the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So, all God has to do to kill, have you killed the Satan, if you take out any goodness that he has within him, so Mimela, all he has within him is evil, he will die from the pure evil that is within him, because pure evil has no chiyus, it has no vitality, and will die of its own accord. I will fully confess to you, I don't fully understand what I just read, but those are the words. Yeah? That's
spiritual culture?
I think that's what he's saying. I think he's saying that even in the world which is beyond physicality, that evil can't doesn't have any standing in that sense. Oh, yes, right. In other words, Yom Shekulo Tov. Right. I mean, we talk about the Olam Haba. You know, it's Yom Shekulo Tov. Right. Oh, yes, l'chol adav. I'm not done yet. Says the Arachayim. Right. Should also know as follows: Ki chol mokar yishaf l'mino v'yishavenu. That like things attract. It's not true that opposites attract. Like items attract one another. V'zehu sod b'chinas biruneit sotzei hakdusha b'emsos nishmas yisrael v'esek torasam. You know, there's a Kabbalistic concept of bringing out the nitzotzei hakedusha, the sparks of kedusha. Yarchaim elsewhere writes that the whole concept of Klal Yisrael coming down to Mitzrayim, why did the Jews have to go to Egypt? Egypt is the source of Tumah. So the Yarchaim writes, again, in a very Kabbalistic fashion, that even though Mitzrayim is a source of Tumah, there are nitzotzei hakedusha, there are little sparks of holiness that are buried deep within the wasteland, the spiritual wasteland, which is Mitzrayim, and the Jews, by going down in Mitzrayim, had to extract those pieces of Kedusha and bring them out from Mitzrayim. In other words, and part of the avoda, part of the task of a Jew in this world, is to extract the nitzotzos haKedusha, these little sparks of Kedusha, from unlikely places and bring them out. How does a Jew do that? So the Arachaim explains that Kedusha attracts Kedusha. You know, there's it's a certain magnetic power that Kedusha has. When Jews come down to Mitzrayim, they, because of their own inherent Kedusha, are able to attract, almost magnetically, so to speak, the Nitzotzos HaKedusha that are hidden in Mitzrayim. They pull them out, they extract them, and then they're able to deal with them, you know, without them being buried in the Tumah of Mitzrayim.
So what's
supreme regard to the Urchayim, that seems not to be what happened, Dafka, that they were on the 49th level of Tumah. So they didn't spark up.
Okay. Elsewhere, again, you know, elsewhere, back in Vo'er, actually, in last week's parasha, the Urchayim discusses the issue, why was it? You know, we were always told that, you know, the Jews were there down to the last minute, and if they would have stayed a minute longer, so they would have been lost in the tomb of Mitzrayim. You know, so why did God wait so long? I mean, in other words, you know, if it's not a big kunz. If you see, Rachman al-Islam, you have a doctor who has a patient who's dying, and the doctor says, you know what, watch this, this is a great trick. I'm going to let the guy get to death's door. And then you'll see, at the last minute, I'm going to snatch him from the jaws of death and bring him back. If a doctor told you that was his MO, you know, I mean, he'd be barred from practicing medicine, right? Was, you don't wait till the last minute, right? Was, you know, maybe we remember from our college days, right? You know, the paper is due in, you know, at 11:59, you know, and 11:50, we're scribbling, you know, typing away, you know, gotta get it in, gotta get it. That's not a way to act, you know, that doesn't yield great results. So the Archaim answer was, why did Rebbe Shlomo let it go so long? I mean, why do you let it go down to, you talk about just in the nick of time. That's not such a great kunst, you know. I mean, take him out a little bit earlier, give him a little bit of cushion. So he says, no, because the whole task of Klal Yisrael Mitzrayim was to take away these nisotzos. And they need to be there to the last minute when they push it, can't do it anymore. Because if they would have gone out 10 minutes early, they would have lost the ability to take away 10 minutes worth of Mitzvot HaKadosh. So even after sinking into the Tumah, even then, again, how this works, I don't know, but even as they sink into the Tumah, they have the ability, they are drawing out these Mitzvot HaKadosh. It's kind of like, you know, the guy going deeper and deeper into the mine shaft. You know, he himself is, you know, gasping for breath, perhaps, as he goes into the mine shaft. But as he goes in, he's pulling out more and more precious metals, you know, as he's going down. I mean, his canary behind him is choking, right? But he's, he's trying to get every last morsel of metal, of precious metal, that he possibly can. The Jews stayed in Mitzrayim until the last minute because they had work to do, says the Arachayim. And you know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to make sure that they would get out, mamish, down to the last drop, every nitzos of Kedusha that they were able to do before they absolutely had to get out of there, before the air was mamish going to run out in the mine. This is the Arachayim's perspective on the whole Golus Mitzrayim. So having said that, right, that's the whole idea of Kedusha. Kedusha attracts Kedusha. A person who has Kedusha draws out mitzvot of Kedusha from the most unlikely places. Tzadikim ha'asumim, katmonenu, right, our forefathers, these unbelievable tzadikim, yakiru b'habitam be'odam rosho levarir mimenu kolach hachiyuni, shubuchinas hatov, b'emsoz hariyah hadakar shiyabitu b'ein hachochma, b'hom sichelik hatov vahu. A tremendous tzaddik, again, a tzaddik of the level of a Tana, you know, a tzaddik of the level of our forefathers, had the ability to look at a Rasha, and through gazing upon that Rasha, the Kedusha of the tzaddik was such that that little bit of Tov in the Rasha was literally sucked out of that Rasha.
Where did it go?
What?
Where did it go?
Into the tzaddik. Tzaddik's a magnet, right? And the tzaddik, as magnet, you know, looks at this Rasha again. Every Rasha who's alive has a little bit of Tov in him, because otherwise he couldn't be alive. That's what the Arachayim told us previously. So this, the tzaddik looks, gazes at the Rasha. The little bit of Tov in the Rasha gets sucked out of the Rasha, magnetically attaches itself to the tzaddik. What happens to the Rasha? The Rasha dies, because he doesn't have any Tov in him anymore to keep him going. What's that?
So why stand?
So hold on a second, right? Kiki she is kaving lomul anaf hakdusha, tatzibo nefesh hatzadik kemaisa evin hashoeves lebarzel hanikres kalmita belas. He evokes the idea of a magnet. That's evin hashoeves. Evin hashoeves is a magnet, right? So I don't know what kalmita is. I assume that's an Arabic word, but I guess if we knew somebody who knew Arabic, it's probably a magnet, I assume. That's what Evin HaShoeves is. Right? So says the Arachayim, the tzaddik is mamish like a magnet, you know, opposite this Rasha. Shetot si'enu mimokom shnik bashom biriyon. The power of a tzaddik's gaze, however this works, is that the tzaddik's gaze functions like a magnet and pulls out the little bit of tov that's in the Rasha. Hold on a second. Hashem also dimyonos ba'olam lahamin odom v'toras chacham. Now, says the Archai, now that I gave you those two hakdomas, right? In other words, a Rasha who's alive is only alive by virtue of the little bit of good that he has within him. And a true tzaddik, by gazing at a Rasha, can literally suck the goodness out of him. And that's how, you know, when the Gemara talks about a tzaddik looked at, you know, this Rasha, and he became a galsha atzolos, became a pile of bones. It means that the power of kedusha that tzaddik has, when focused on the rasha, you know, it's not that he has death ray vision. It's that the tov within this rasha was sucked out of him, came to the tzaddik, and the rasha dropped it. Now understand, he says how machas b'choros work. That's who meis kol b'chor pirush. I'm sorry. Yes. So I don't think it's a question of a conscious choice. Meaning, this is—it's almost like it's a natural law. Kedusha attracts kedusha, right? And I think the Archaim is almost saying that in the cases of the Tanoim in the Mishnah, in the Gemara, or you know, the Tanoim, the Amoraim, and the Gemara, where they looked at somebody and killed him, I get the impression from the Archaim he's almost saying it's not as if they meant to do this. This almost happened mimela. In other words, almost. You know, the tzaddik can't help it. He's such a powerful magnet of kedusha. You know, the gravitational pull of the tzaddik is such that, you know, just as a law of nature, the tov is sucked out of the rasha and he drops dead. Now, to suck the rishas out of the rasha obviously would be much more effective in a certain long sense. But it don't work like that. In other words, the science of Kedusha, however this works exactly, is that Kedusha attracts Kedusha. Kedusha can't attract Rishus.
Was it
Rebbe
and his wife who said, don't curse the
Rasha,
don't curse
the Rishus. Right.
So one of this case, the Rishus,
right, so again,
the contact that this Rasha might have with the Tzaddik would to
fan the flames. Right. So the question is, you know, so wouldn't it be better from a Kiruv perspective, you know, instead of, you know, sucking the life out of this Rasha to kind of sit down with him, make him into a tzaddik? I think I would say, again, this is not a question of a conscious choice, you know, that the tzaddik is contemplating, well, should I learn with this guy, bring him to a Shabbaton, or zap him dead? Oh, let's think about it a little bit, right? I think I'm saying this is almost like a law of nature. You know, that the Kedusha of the Tzaddik is such that, ask me, you know, why should a magnet attract? Right? You know, why should a magnet attract? Maybe it's better if the magnet would repel. Right? So, the answer is, that's the way the Ribbono Shel Olam made the world. That's it. It's a law of science. It is. You know, don't ask me why. It is. Right, so I think they are kind of saying this as well. This is a law of science. This is not a technique. This is not a plan that the tzaddik has. This is when a tzaddik, you know, interacts with the rasha under certain conditions. Whatever kedusha the rasha has is sucked into the tzaddik. That's just it is. Yeah.
I'm a little bit perplexed. Like, why would a Jew want to put himself in harm's way? I mean, just even to approach a Russian who's complete outward, you know, if you want to say that, I don't know how to say it in English. This whole aura is one of hate, and he's an anti-Semite, connected to Israel. But what's not for him? Why do I have to even go to this guy? I would get myself and pull myself out of his, you know, in his conflict. It's like, I'm sorry to say, who would want to walk in East New York at 1 o'clock in the morning without time to shook it?
Sometimes it happens, you know.
I know, but...
Okay, so this tzaddik, for whatever reason, you know, came into contact with the Russian. It happens. You know, you can't always seal off the world, you know, numerically. Yeah.
So what he's saying is that because this Russia has just a tiny bit of good in it, and the Tzaddik has so much, so the magnetic force is greater. But if, let's say, the Tzaddik was dealing with the Bane in it, would he pull out the good in it?
Right, so the question is, you know, would a Tzaddik pull out the goodness and the Bane in me? So I suspect the Aruch Haim would say no. In other words, the truth is the best way, I think, in modern scientific terms to understand this Aruch Haim is gravitational pull. I mean, what he's describing is a kind of spiritual gravitational pull. That a huge body will exert a tremendous pull on a much smaller body. Right? So the huge Kedusha of the Tzaddik exerts such a huge pull on the little, minute Kedusha, which is in the Russia, that it Pashit yanks it out and pulls it, you know, almost all the way to the Tzaddik. Right? In other words, you know, imagine a huge heavenly body, you know, exerting such an incredible gravitational pull on a relatively small. Right, you know, something like that, like a black hole or something of that nature. Right? In other words, you know, you get within the gravitational pull of the Earth, and you have no choice but to fall to the Earth. You know, if you're a small, asteroid or something of that nature.
I'm just wondering if we can touch the word before Tzaddik, and we Yivarech, that the Tzaddik is like you go to a Rebbe, and the Rebbe supposedly looks down the road. He has the ability to see what's going on down the road. We don't understand how they have that.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it means. That right. Tzaddik, you can see further down the road. And advise accordingly.
Yeah, could be. I hear. So let's come back to Makkos Bukharis for a moment. Right? So, Umeato Nimsa Dasa Lukim Ba'omu Meis Kol Bukhar. Now understand the Pasuk. It doesn't say, again, to go back to Yerachim's Chaim's original question, the Pasuk doesn't say that Hashem will kill all of the firstborn in Egypt. It says Hashem will pass through Egypt and all the firstborn will die. Passive voice. Why put it passively? I'm not going to have to kill the Bukharim, says the Ribbono Shel Olam. I'm going to pass through Mitzrayim. And I'm a super body of Kedusha. I mean, there's no Kedusha like the Ribbono Shel Olam. Right? So what's going to happen? The incredible gravitational pull of God's Kedusha going through Mitzrayim is going to yank the little bit of Kedusha out of every Bechor in Mitzrayim, and Mimela, Umeis, they will die. They will not be killed. Right? In other words, it's not a proactive act of murder, which the Ribbono Shel Olam is doing, or killing, which the Ribbono Shel Olam is doing. Right? It's almost, they will die on their own. Because the Bechias, you know, this life will be sucked out of their bodies.
That's good. Right? You're saying that the person has Kedusha.
Hold on a second. It's mamish like the same thing that the Gemara is talking about, that the Tzaddikim would look at a Rasha and render him a pile of bones. Again, the same thing, the Kedusha gets sucked out of them. Right? All life will just be taken out of them. That's what's going to happen over here. The neshamas of the Bukharis are going to be yanked out of them of their own accord. Understand this. The Omro, Kol Bukhar. Furthermore, understand the follows. It says, Umeis Kol Bukhar. Every Bukhar will die, but the way that the Aruch Haim understands, not only will every Bukhar die, but all of each Bukhar will die, he explains. Pirush. In this case, not only will the nefesh, the neshama, be sucked out of the body, kol b'chor means that the, you know, previously we said that the tov gets sucked to the tzaddik, and the person just dies. Here he says the pull of God's kedusha is such that not only will the body of the Bukhar be destroyed, but on some level the neshama of the Bukhar is going to be destroyed. That's pshat umeis kol Bukhar. Not just every Bukhar, but the entirety of the Bukhar will be killed. V'ulai, ki bozel lo nisatsem shum galus od, ki buchinas galus v'shibur Mitzrayim, ki ovar koach haklipa otzem shu buchinas Bukhar. The Aruch Haim understands that the death of the Bukharos were not just significant in terms of, oh, these are powerful or firstborn people in Egypt and they need to die. Bechor represents something, you know, fundamentally evil and sinister. It was the same way that, you know, in a Jewish context, a Bechor has Kedusha. In a Egyptian context, the Bechoros were killed, not just because they were important people in Mitzrayim, but a Bechor in Mitzrayim represented the pinnacle of the idea of Tumah. That's what he's saying. He's talking about the idea of Koach HaKlipa HaOtzum Shubachinas Bechor, the power of the Klipa, the peel. Klipa in Kabbalistic terminology is always a negative thing. It means, you know, those elements of evil which are not good, you know, which are Klipa. They are like a peel of an orange that needs to be thrown away and discarded and has no inherent value. Like as much as Egypt was a place of Tumah, the Bechoros of Egypt epitomized that Tumah, and the destruction of the Bechoros was not just significant in its own right, you know, it wasn't just, you know, a way of scaring the Egyptians, but the destruction of the Bechoros on a deeper level represented the destruction of that pinnacle of Tumah which existed in Egypt. Egypt was not a Tumah anymore after the Bechoros had died, because the Bechoros epitomized that idea of Tumah. And that's what he says, and the galus, therefore, of Mitzrayim was never repeated later on in history in quite, you know, the spiritual depths of Mitzrayim were never paralleled in later history. I guess his source for that is the idea that you don't find the Jewish people sinking to levels of Tumah the way they're described as sinking to that in Mitzrayim. You know, and he says that, you know, there was a certain, the Makas Bechoros cleared away a certain degree of evil from the world. It wasn't just a matter of, you know, killing certain people. So, I mean, that's an important point from his perspective, because it addresses the following question. I mean, Egypt is chock full of Rishoyim, right? So how come Davka the Bechoros died? Again, the way, in the conventional understanding that God goes to a Mitzrayim and kills off the Bechoros, okay, so the Bechoros died, because that's what God decided to kill. But now, in the Archaim's understanding, that the Bechoros die almost on their own accord. In other words, they die as a result of being exposed to the intense Kedusha of the Ribbono Shel Olam revealing himself in Mitzrayim. So how come that affected Davka the Bechoros and not the tons of other Rishonim who were in Mitzrayim? How come, you know, tons of Rishonim didn't drop dead on the night of Makas Bechoros? I think the Archaim would answer to that, because the Bechoros were they represented Rishus to a much greater extent than the Stam Rishoyim in Mitzrayim. The Bechoros, not only in their own right, but represented this concept of the pinnacle of Rishus, and they really had just a tiny bit of Tov holding them together. So Davka, those Rishoyim, the Bechoros, were the ones who dropped dead on that night. There were other Rishoyim, but they had a little more Tov in them, and, you know, they had enough gravitational pull on their end to be able to keep the Tov intact and not have to fly out, you know, and be extinguished because of the great Kedusha of the Ribbono Shel Olam passing through.
What about the incense?
So he's suggesting, again, I think it goes beyond the merits or lack thereof of a particular person. He's suggesting Bechor in its very essence represents a type of evil. In other words, it's not just a question of figuring out the merits or demerits of a particular person. To be a Bechor in a society like Mitzrayim inherently carries evil with it.
Right, but could you be a Bechor before you have Bechira?
Yeah. So that's what, I mean, in other words, the same way that we... I guess you have to define a little bit more precisely. It's not just a question of evil, but a question of Tumah, which may be separated from one's moral choice, but whatever the Archaim is describing over here exactly, I think it's the flip side of Kedusha for a Bechor Yisrael. In other words, a Jewish Bechor comes into the world. We understand from the Torah that a Jewish firstborn has Kedusha. Now, that doesn't mean he's a good guy. I mean, again, he's out in the world for all of 10 minutes, right? He's not tzaddik, right? But somehow, being a Bechor in a Jewish context means that the kid has Kedusha. So, whatever the flip side of that is for a Bechor Mitzri, means that a Bechor Mitzri has some deep Tumah which is inherent to his very existence and is not a result of the moral choices that he makes. How do you understand that? I don't know, right? But I think that's implicit in in, you know, what he's saying here in the piece.
Also, from a humanistic point of view, from nature, usually it's the b'chor, the oldest child, gets blamed for everything. You should have known better.
Yeah, you're b'chor too?
Yeah,
you and me both,
yeah.
Right. So again, you can explain that way, but I think the Archaim is going deeper than that. The Archaim is saying it's not just, you know, older son, you know, he should see a therapist and talk about his difficult childhood. You know, there's some kiddusha with it, something inherent, you know, which is beyond just his particular experiences. I mean, B'chor Behema. I mean, B'chor Behema. Forget about B'chor Ashvi, right?
B'chor Behema might
have been something different. B'chor Ashvi was from that other... Right. So hold on 2 minutes. Let's good segue. V'ra'isi losseis pam. Lama loyosi sa'am v'msos makas b'choros. Right, first of all, once we've explained this idea, very fascinating idea, I'm not sure I totally understand it, maybe you all totally understand it, but again, very fascinating idea. But once we have this idea, says the Archaim, let me raise another point. Why was the last Makas Bechoros? I mean, I guess, you know, it's not the biggest kasha in the world, you know, I mean, anything else that would have been the last Makas, you would have asked, why was the last Makas, whatever it was. But, you know, is it just arbitrary? You know, God was kind of flipping through his Rolodex, kiviyachol. And he was deciding, okay, 10 plays, let's see, what do we got, you know, let's hit it. Yeah, Makas Becharis, that sounds pretty good. Or was it something more fundamental than that? So the Archaim is going to suggest that Makas Becharis is more fundamental. Ode, furthermore, Lama Hashem Hika, Afilu Bechor She'eno Mitzri, Dixiv Bechor Ashvi. How do you explain the fact, as Yaakov mentioned a moment ago, how do you explain the fact that God struck down the non-Egyptian Becharis, i.e., the firstborn of the captives, right? Captives means people who are not Egyptians, who were taken in war. How do you explain that? Fulai, ki atam hu litzav shemotzinu kishakara asher leisav b'ni b'chori. Perhaps, the reason is based on the following idea. We find in the very, very beginning of Sefer Shmos that, you know, God says, b'ni b'chori Yisrael, the Jewish people are my firstborn. Ukvar ho diyunu rabuseinu, you should know that the Zohar tells us that for every good thing in the world, there's a mirror image in the world of evil. Right? Everything is created with a mirror image. For everything that's good, there's a mirror image that's evil. Right? And for every element of Kedusha that exists out there, there's a nemesis. You know, there's something in the klipa, in the peel. Again, the klipa being a reference to the ultimate powers of tumma and lack of kedusha. Everything that's kadosh has its parallel in the world of tumma. Right? There's a nemesis. There's a mirror image. You know, for every good thing that's out there. The klipa mis'ametzes u'mischazekes le'echoz bo. And you know, these two mirror images, the kedusha and the klipa, are not simply live and let live. They're locked in battle, and the klipa is constantly looking to pull down its kedusha counterpart. Right? Think of it as everything in the world is Yaakov and Esav. Right? Everything in the world has, you know, there's a kedusha equivalent and a klipa equivalent, and they're locked in eternal battle in much the way that Esav and Yaakov described in the Chumash. Of, you know, la'omi la'om yemas, you know, that they're constantly, you know, fighting and struggling with one another. Uvelazeh, keneged b'chinas ha'b'chor shebikdusha, ha'is b'chinas ha'b'chor shebiklipa, ochezes v'tokefes bo, leval shalach, ad asher horag Hashem kol shem ha'b'chor shebiklipas mitzrayim, bein shal mitzrayim, bein shal ha'umo shehayu sham. Tiksiv ad b'chor ha'shvi, u'b'chor ha'shivcha, b'chor behema. Right? If the Jewish people collectively are called Bechor, then the flip side of that, in other words, the Bechoros in Mitzrayim, which again he's saying are not just, it's not just about individuals. Bechor Mitzrayim is a typology. It somehow represents an element out there in the world which is opposed to the Kedusha of Klal Yisrael as a whole. So the Becharos of Mitzrayim are locked in struggle with the entire Jewish people. Again, perhaps not literally, but what they represent is the antithesis of Klal Yisrael itself, and the only way to let Klal Yisrael free is to destroy this nemesis, is to destroy the Bechor of the Klipa. So anything in Mitzrayim which can be labeled as a Bechor, whether Bechor of Mitzrayim, or Bechor of, you know, non-Mitzri nations who end up there, or even animal Bechoros, right? All of these Bechoros have to go in order to send the Jewish people free. In other words, the notion of Makas Bechoros being the last Makkah is not just arbitrary. It's not, God could have, you know, not, well, God says, okay, Bechoros, maybe something else, you'll see. No, it had to be Bechoros, and it had to be the death of the last Makkah, because the death of the Bechoros is freeing the Kedusha of Klal Yisrael from that element in the world that was looking to drag it down. Now, the Jewish people breaking free from the Tumah of Mitzrayim is wrapped up with that whole idea of the death of the Bechoros. It's not just that, you know, Hashem says, oh, let me send them something that's going to scare them. No, in other words, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when we talk about the Jewish people were sinking into Tumah and they needed to be freed from that, part of the freedom from that is the death of the Bechoros. Yeah.
But it's, you can't, you know, you're not attributing a magnetic force to the Bechoros, saying that their evil is keeping Klal Yisrael from leaving.
It's not a magnetic force. In other words, they are locked in combat with the Jewish people, and through that combat, preventing the Jewish people from leaving, they're dragging them down further and further into Tumah. The Gam Bechor Yisrael Kideish Osam Ke'omro Kol Bechor Igashti Osam Li Kideish Lo Tishar Bechor Azula Shel Kodesh Asher Ekdish LaShem. Right, so you know the result after Yetzias Mitzrayim that the Bechoros of Klal Yisrael become Kodesh is God's attempt, or God's successful attempt, right, to say the whole concept of Bechor, which previously could have been Kadosh and could have been very much the opposite of that, Bechor is going to be associated entirely with Kedusha. Ad Kedekach, not only will the Jewish people as a whole be called Bechor and be holy, but even the Bechoros within the Bechoros, in other words, the Bechoros within Klal Yisrael, are going to be considered to be Kadosh, right? And that's why even the Bechoros of the Behemos died in Mitzrayim, because anything that was associated with Bechor of Tumah had to go. The Kivan Sheneka Hashem Zer, once Bechor was knocked out, Nafal HaNafara, Shahir Machzik BeBechor HaKedusha, right? So whatever was grasping onto the Bechor of Kedusha, of Klal Yisrael, fell down. Was that take if Yosef ben Yisrael, Bagam Shematz, right? And that's why the Jewish people were free to go immediately after Makas Bechoros. Paro runs and says, okay, now go. Right? In other words, it's so immediate after a year of stalling, and I'm not, it's not just that he was frightened. You know, in a spiritual sense, whatever was holding the Jewish people back, which was associated with that idea of the Bechoros, that spell was broken by the Makas Bechoros, and the Jewish people were able to leave. Right? And, you know, true, he says the Mitzrayim ran after the Jewish people at that point, but it was all over. In other words, the Mitzrayim's hold over the Jewish people was severed, you know, not just physically, but spiritually as well, through the ideas of Makas Bechoros. I want to come back for a moment to the first point which the Archaim makes. Again, you know, I think if you wanted to summarize, there are three points that Archaim is making over here. First, initially, he introduces the idea that it doesn't. It says it umeis kol bechor, and not v'horanti kol bechor, because God, you know, only deals out evil through delegation, right? So that's his first point. Number two, another way to understand umeis kol bechor, this fascinating idea of God as the source of kedusha sucks out whatever kedusha is in the Mitzrayim, and thus causes them to die indirectly, as opposed to killing them directly. That's the whole idea of, you know, how Makas Bechoros worked, right? And third, this idea that Makas Bechoros was not chosen arbitrarily as the last straw to allow the Jews to go out, but Makas Bechoros on a deeper level represents the breaking of the bonds of Tumah, which are keeping the Jewish people in place. And, you know, once those bonds are broken, Mimela, it's a simple thing for the Jewish people to get out of Mitzrayim because their antithesis, their nemesis, you know, the Bechor of Klipa is no longer extant and can't hold them back anymore from leaving Mitzrayim. Yeah?
There's a lot of discussion. The Rav is discussing the Orachaim, good and evil. Good and evil. The distinction between good and evil. But it's not 100% clear to me. How does that apply? How does that apply to the Makos specifically? In other words, the Makos, you know, how is he softening the blow with the Orachaim? In other words, they were what they were. They were.
I don't think the Orachaim is softening the blow.
No,
I mean, no. The Orachaim is giving us an insight as to the mechanics of Makos Bechoros. How did it work? So it's not just, you know, the way we were taught in elementary school, you know, the Ribbono Shel Olam came down, he waved his magic wand, and boom, you know, they all fell dead. He's giving us a little bit more of a nuanced understanding. They died of their own accord because a Rasha exposed to great Kedusha will collapse. That's essentially what he's saying over here. Right? Now, yeah.
It's basically those who were Klal Yisrael and Har Sinai when they basically will collapse also as a result of Kedusha.
Oh. So let me augment this Orach Chaim. So my late Rosh Hashiva, Chaim Yaakov Goldberg, Sechet Tzadik with Rachos, Rosh Hashiva in Keren Biavna for many, many years, cited this Orach Chaim in his drashas, and it's written up in the first volume of the Asufas Ma'arachos, you know, the sefer of his various drashas and shiurim and machshava. That this volume came out during his lifetime. There are many, many volumes that have come out since his p'tira, but the Goldberg Zechet Tzadik Livracha took this Orach Chaim and he went a step further with it. Right? The Orach Chaim talks about the incredible power of its tzaddik through re'iyah, through looking at someone or something, because remember that's the discussion about the Tanarim and the Amoraim, Yahavu Be'ene, right? As they placed their eyes on someone, they stared at someone, they gazed at this Rasha and killed him through their gaze. Right, which is the Orach Chaim's discussion. The Orach Chaim discusses this in a negative sense. In other words, that the tzaddik staring at a rasha can suck out the kedusha from that person. Again, and the way we understood that in, you know, somewhat semi-scientific terms, was as a kind of gravitational pull. The tzaddik's kedusha is so overwhelming that the tiny little bit of kedusha this rasha has is literally sucked out and, you know, is gone. But Sefer Goldberg, but the truth is, the Orach Chaim's idea also has an application in a much more positive sense. Namely, that the same way that tzaddik, through looking at someone or something, can create a connection, a magnetic connection, which serves to suck out a little bit of Kedusha, where there's more Kedusha to work with in the person, or in the being, the tzaddik, through looking at someone or something, can infuse it with Kedusha as well. In other words, it's a little bit of a two-way street, right? Now, in this particular case, there's such big Kedusha on the Tzaddik's end, and there's such little Kedusha on the Rosh's end, that like gravitational pull, you know, the small body just, you know, just runs all the way over to the other side, to the bigger body. But if you were to have something a little bit more equitable, so then actually there would be an attraction between the two that would meet somewhere in the middle. So Goldberg took that idea and he said, you know, we find in several places in Tanakh and in Chazal that re'iyah, or looking at something, has some significance. So let's take two examples from the Chumash, one from the very beginning of Chumash, one from the very end of Chumash. Right? The very beginning of Chumash, the Ribbono Shel Olam creates the world, and a common refrain throughout the Shesh Yisrimei Bereishis is Vayara Elokim Kitov. God saw that it was good. And when you read that pasuk, you know, as it appears over and over again in the Shesh Yisrimei Bereishis, you ask yourself, what does that mean? You know, I mean, in human terms, I understand it. In other words, you know, a guy is working on a project. He's writing an essay. The first one just went off. Okay. Guy's writing an essay. You know, so he's working and working and working. And, you know, whenever you're working in something, you don't have, you're so obsessed with the small details, you don't necessarily look at the big picture. you know, and so the guy finishes the essay and he, you know, takes a breath, pours himself a drink, sits down to actually read the essay, and he says, yeah, you know, this is pretty good. I did a good job over here. Right? That's a human reaction. So, in human terms, I understand that. There, I mean, in human terms, if the Ribbono Shel Olam was a human artisan, and, you know, making the world, so after every day, he steps back at the end of a long day's work, and he kind of brushes off his pants, and he takes a look, and he says, oh, taka, it's a very nice day today. I did well. These fish, these birds, whoa, it's gewaltig. Vayalukim kitov. But how do you say that about the Ribbono Shel Olam? I mean, that, you know, in God's terms, those words don't make sense. But the Ribbono Shel Olam, you know, got so caught up in all the hard work he was doing that day. He took a look at the end of the... He took a look at what he had done during that day. And he said, woo, taka, not there, not there, not there. Good job, good job. Let's see what we can do tomorrow. You can't say such a thing. I'll get in some trouble for saying what I said, you know. But you can't say such a thing about the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's a human being, you know, but not God. So Zot the Rosh Hashiva Zot of Goldwich. You know what it means? You understand it based on this Arachayim. The Ribbono Shel Olam, at the end of every day, the Ribbono Shel Olam, who is the Makar HaKedusha, wanted to invest Kedusha in the world. Vayar Elokim Kitov is a way of the Torah saying God invested Kedusha in the creations of that day, at the end of each day, through the power of Re'iyah, through the power of looking at something. Because we see that the looking of a tzaddik, of someone who is a source of Kedusha, can have tremendous powers. It can attract Kedusha. It can bestow Kedusha. Right? So the Ribbono Shel Olam, Vayar Elokim Kitov, it's not descriptive. It's creative. It's not that God looked at it and said, oh, taka is good. Vayar Elokim, by looking at it, Kitov, he made it good. He invested the Kedusha in that particular creation.
Right.
So the back of Rebbe, right. Right. So I think that Gemara, again, you know, the fact that, you know, had I saw the back, had I seen the front of that Tana. Right, no, so but I think that Gemara can fit in, doesn't necessarily have to fit in, but I think it can fit in, namely, that, you know, when you're dealing with two sources of Kedusha, again, we're talking about two Tanoim over here, one's a Rebbe, one's a Talmud, but two sources of Kedusha, so either way, the Re'iyah forms a bond, forms a bridge over which the Kedusha can travel. Right.
So that should be touched again. Tell you by who you were off the river, right. Look at his talent, mm-hmm. Because he had that potential.
Right, exactly.
You work with him.
Right, right.
Same thing, I guess on our level, we can understand the Rabbi Shalom, this thing for what he is creating.
Right. So that's what Goldberg says, you know, that the very re'ir, the very looking of the Rabbi Shalom, you know, that's investing Kedusha. That's a creative act. It's not let's sit back at the end of the day and, oh, good, nice job, you know. No, that's part of the gracious. That's part of the creation.
And going back to what the function of the Sefer Arachti, even though I'm reading that happened in the world through the Rebbe Shalom is doing,
right.
But I didn't do it.
Right.
But you guys caused your own death.
Right. You're responsible for the evil that you...
Right. Yeah, 100%. That's why I don't have to say it.
Right.
It's because of your action.
Right, 100%. So that's the beginning of Chumash. Let's fast forward, or I guess you could just turn it back the other way. Let's fast forward to the end of Chumash, right? So the Ribbono Shel Olam tells Moshe Rabbeinu, you can't go into Eretz Yisrael, just go up and take a look. Now, the truth is, if I were Moshe Rabbeinu, I would almost say, I don't want to look. You know, what was this, a tease? You know, you can't go in. Just look. You know, haha, can't go in. Sorry, you know. Right? I mean, it's almost cruel. You know, you go up to the top of the mountain. You can look, I'll show you with your eyes, but don't even think of going in. So don't show him. I mean, Ribbono Shel Olam, you know what I mean? Like, it's not nice. It's not nice. I mean, you know, a kid loses a contest. So you take him over to the corner and say, you see this bicycle? This is what you would have won. had you won, but you didn't win. So you're not going to get it. Sorry. Don't show the bicycle. I want the... Says Rav Goldberg, no, you don't understand. The re'i of Moshe Rabbeinu on Eretz Yisrael was not, you know, to satisfy his curiosity or to somehow, you know, certainly wasn't to tease him or to torture him or, you know, to tantalize him in any way. Moshe Rabbeinu was a source of Kedusha. He had to invest Eretz Yisrael with the Kedusha that he possessed. How do you do that? Re'i, looking at it. It was incredibly important for Moshe Rabbeinu to look at Eretz Yisrael, to invest the spirituality, the ruchnius that he possessed, into Eretz Yisrael before the Jews went over. And in fact, you find, I mean, it's very striking. The Chumash spends a lot of time in the very last chapter of Devarim describing how he looked at all of Eretz Yisrael. Right? The Pasuk, you know, doesn't just say, oh, he went up and he looked. Right? Vayareu Hashem es kol haaretz, es hagilon, adon, v'yeis kol naftoli, v'yeis eretz Ephraim u'menashe, v'yeis kol eretz Yehuda, anayom ha'acharon, v'yeis ha'negev, v'yeis ha'kikor, v'yeis yirecho, ir ha'tmarim ha'tsoa. It gives you the whole, you know, description of Eretz Yisrael. Why did Maris? He took him up to the top of the mountain, he showed him the Eretz Yisrael. I mean, every word in the Torah is precious, every letter in the Torah is precious. Why describe it? Because, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu, you have to imagine, is looking and gazing over here. And Naphtali, all of a sudden, the chelik of Naphtali becomes Kaddish. And he looks over at Dan, and the chelik of Dan becomes Kaddish. And he looks over at Yericho, and the chelik of Yericho becomes Kaddish. And, you know, basically what the Torah is describing is the creation of a certain kind of Kedusha in Eretz Yisrael through the eyesight of Moshe Rabbeinu.
Right,
so it's interesting. In other words, how do you tie this in to the incredible light of Moshe Rabbeinu's face and the fact that he had to cover it with a mask? Right. So I guess it's all a matter of degrees, meaning. I mean, consider, you know, the way electricity works as well. You know, you have the right amount of electricity, the fan works. You have too much electricity, it blows a fuse. You know, I mean, try to do too much with the electricity, it just doesn't work at all. Right? So I guess the same thing is true with this. I mean, the truth is the parallels between magnetism and electricity, between what he's talking about, are very striking. I mean, this is written by someone who lives in the 1700s. You know, it's a ways away. You know, everything in its right measure. You know, maybe the Kedusha of Moshe Rabbeinu was so overpowering, it didn't destroy them, but at the same time, it was hard for them to perceive it. And, you know, in a different context, just looking at Eretz Yisrael, that amazing, incredible Kedusha, which radiated literally from his face, was enough to invest Eretz Yisrael with a certain type of Kedusha.
But couldn't he infuse more Kedusha if he went into Eretz Yisrael? Like, if you take a laser gun, the closer you are to a target, the more power it has.
Right, so...
Why not long distance?
Again, the Rebbe Shalom decided that he shouldn't go into Eretz Yisrael. The Archaim Grada has a very famous pshat from that, which actually fits in with what you're saying. The Archaim says, had Moshe Rabbeinu gone to Eretz Yisrael, built the Beis HaMikdash, it would have been so Kedush, it never would have been destroyed. And when the Rebbe Shalom came to destroy the Beis HaMikdash, he would be unable, kivyachol, to do so, and he would have had to have destroyed the Jewish people.
Wow.
So it was in the best interest. So the truth is, the Archaim Lashitaso, I think, supports your point, meaning, had he actually come into Eretz Yisrael, he would have invested it with super duper, extra super Kedusha, so much so that it would have been counterproductive. Right? So, better have him invest it with a little bit from a distance, because too much of a good thing can also... be a terrible thing.
In a way, maybe the Kedusha of Tzaddikim that we have living today in Eretz Yisrael,
right. Every
Yisrael can't be destroyed.
Right. Okay, so this is a fascinating assignment of Goldust applications. Can Sufis Marachus... I'm sorry?
So you learn this all
the time. There you go. So, this Arachayim is a fascinating idea. The Asubas Marachos, the Hosafa from Rav Goldberg, is really quite something. That's actually what we'll pick up next week with Pashas Peshalach and more enjoyable Arachayim.